So this is one of the observational talks, so it's extra long. I think I get, what, 4 hours?
Without question.
Well, you've got to stop by noon because that's what the discussion is.
So the topic is magnetic fields and star formation, but there's a subtitle. As you know, cosmologists like to talk about dark matter, dark energy, and those are things which don't have an electromagnetic signature. And as we'll see, even though magnetic fields may have a very important role in dynamics, they're hard to detect. They have a very weak electromagnetic signature, which is the reason why the volume of data is a lot less than one might desire. So the motivation is to test star formation theory. And as we all know, there are two kind of extreme case models. Compressible turbulence with negligible magnetic fields, and again, these are extreme case models. The idea is that turbulence forms dense clumps, some of which are self-gravitating in the collapse, and the rest may fall apart. And the opposite extreme is magnetic support and ambipolar diffusion. Turbulence can be present, but it doesn't play a dominant role in the formation of cores and star formation. So magnetic fields being only frozen to the ions, the neutrals can contract under gravity, building up mass in the core until it overwhelms the magnetic field and you form stars. There are various ways to try to distinguish between these two. Models.
There is a pointer to your right.
That's the twilight point.
I don't know what happened. It's just gone out of focus. But because one of the major distinguishing differences is magnetic field strength, observations of magnetic fields are one very important way to try to test and distinguish between these theories. So here's a couple of ways that one can try to do this. One is the magnetic field morphology. This is a model of a core and shows very smooth field lines. They're parallel to the minor axis, and you end up getting this hourglass type morphology because, of course, it's the tension of the bent field lines that are providing the magnetic support. And here's a simulation of a interstellar medium where the magnetic field is present but much weaker than in this case. And so you get a more chaotic, the magnetic field directions are indicated by these blue line segments. And if you home in on a core, you can see that the field morphology looks very different from that. Here's a case where the magnetic field appears to sort of go through a right angle, although these aren't necessarily connected field lines. So one way to try to decide which of these is correct is to look at the field morphology and see.
The field is weakest in the core. Is that just because of projection?
The length of these line segments is not necessarily proportional to the magnetic field strength. There's a lot of other factors which can affect that. For example,
those are polarization vectors. And so the length of the vectors are proportional to the degree of polarization. And the degree of polarization is known to drop inside cores for several reasons. One is the fact that the grain alignment efficiency because of the lack of radiation field.
Yep. The question is, in this case, is it true that the magnetic field is weaker than core?
No, the field is stronger.
Yeah. This tells you the direction of the field, but not anything directly about its magnitude. It's only the morphology that one can talk about here. I'll talk about that in a little more detail in just a moment. A slightly more direct test is to determine the mass to flux ratio, which is basically just the ratio of gravity, which would want to make a cloud or a core collapse, to magnetic support. And there's a theoretical expression for that. You can observe it because the observed mass to flux ratio is just proportional to the column density over the magnetic field strength. And so you can define what I call lambda, but some people call gamma or mu, as the ratio of the observed to the critical. And here's a ambipolar diffusion calculation showing a prediction. It starts off subcritical. Ambipolar diffusion drives the mass to flux ratio to a critical value at some point, and then it becomes supercritical subsequently. The weak magnetic field models don't make any what you might call direct prediction of this, but of course if magnetic fields are not important, then the mass deflux ratio would be supercritical.
Before you go, the theoretical issue that is not of very much practical significance in this context, that mass to flux ratio, the critical one that Nakano and Nakamura got in 1978, is for an infinitesimally thin disk, which is infinite in the plane on the disk, mm-hmm. and uniform. Mm-hmm. And the 1976 result we got with Spitzer is from a nonlinear calculation, three-dimensional, and it differs by about 23% for that. As I said, it's a theoretical issue for the practical significance.
Yeah, I use that because that's what most of the theorists, except for yourself, seem to use. But you can use either one. But again, at the level at which you could measure these things, a 23% difference doesn't really matter. So. So there are three major observational techniques that we can employ: the Zeeman effect, polarization of emission from paramagnetic grains, and linear polarization of spectral lines, which is related to the Zeeman effect, but is basically just telling you again the same kind of information that you get from dust polarization, that is the direction of the field. This is a slightly complicated physical mechanism, which I could describe, but I'm not going to do today because it'll take some time. And I'm not actually, for the most part, going to use this technique today, again, because of time constraints. So I want to talk a little bit about the Zeeman effect, just so everybody's on the same page as to exactly the kind of information you can get from this. As you know, in the presence of a magnetic field, magnetic sublevels are split. And in the simplest case, you get potentially then three polarized spectral lines. If the magnetic field is perpendicular to the magnetic, if the magnetic field is perpendicular to the line of sight, then you get an unsplit, unshifted component, which is perpendicular to the, say, plane of sky magnetic field, and you get two shifted so-called sigma components, which are parallel to the magnetic field direction. And the amount of this splitting in frequency space is given by the magnetic field strength times a parameter I call Z, which depends upon the species you're observing. It's typically 1 or 2 hertz per microgauss. For example, for H1, it's 1.4 hertz per microgauss. In the case of the field along the line of sight, you get exactly the same splitting, but now the lines are circularly polarized. There's not an unsplit pi component, and they're oppositely circularly polarized. Whether right circular polarization is shifted to lower or higher frequency tells you whether the field is pointing toward you or away from you. So you get that kind of information. Now, unfortunately, most species don't have strong Zeeman effects. To get a strong Zeeman effect, you need an unpaired electron. And then this factor Z is proportional to the Bohr magneton. And there are really only three species for which the Zeeman effect has been detected in the interstellar medium. These three, with the exception of water masers. Water masers is a case where you don't have paired electrons, and the Zeeman splitting factor is proportional to the nuclear magneton, some three orders of magnitude less. The reason you can detect Zeeman splitting in water masers is water masers occur at high densities where the magnetic field strengths are typically tens of milligauss, and water masers, of course, are very, very strong. But except for that one case, if you're going to look for the magnetic field strength in the distributed interstellar medium, for the time being, you're stuck with those species. Searches have been made in other species, and so far, no detection of the interstellar Zeeman effect has been made in any other species. Well, you might think that this gives you all the information you need to measure the magnetic vector, because if you measure the linear polarization Stokes parameters Q and U and figure out what you would detect, it turns out this is what you'll get. You'll get a spectrum which is proportional to the second derivative of Stokes I with respect to frequency, and then this dependence on the line of sight between the field and that angle between the magnetic field and the line of sight. And so in principle, that will give you information about both the magnitude and the direction of the field in the plane of the sky. Unfortunately, because of this squared dependence, these linear Stokes parameters are proportional to the Zeeman splitting over the line width squared. And this Zeeman splitting frequency in typical cases, is only of order 1 or a few percent of the line width. And so you have a number here which is 0.01 squared, which is 10 to the minus 4. Totally undetectable by any techniques that we have right now.
What are the limits of sensitivity for detecting?
Something of order 10 to the minus 3.
So you're missing by only a factor of 10.
Then. Right. Mm-hmm. So but to make that up, I mean, receivers are already as good as they can get, quantum mechanically, basically. So to make that up, you need a factor of 100 in observing time. Mm-hmm. And so it in principle could be done, but it would take just a tremendous amount of observing time.
Collecting area, like will the SKA be able to do?
No, that won't help. That'll enable you to get, SKA will mainly give you the advantage of resolution and not really help you that much in terms of overall raw sensitivity to spectral lines. Actually, I hadn't thought about it, but there may be a way you could take advantage of that and do that.
Because they have 100 times the collecting.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Depends on how you use it. It may be possible to do something along those lines. I'll have to think about that. In any case, what you mainly measure is the circular polarization Stokes parameter V, just the difference between left and right. And when the splitting is very small, it just is proportional to the first derivative of the Stokes parameter I. And so this is the expected pattern that you get, the Stokes parameter V pattern. The shape is determined entirely by the derivative with respect to frequency, and the free parameter is just the amplitude of this wiggle. That tells you the magnetic field strength. And whether it goes down, up, or up, down, tells you whether the field's pointing toward or away from you. So this is a severe constraint on what we know about interstellar magnetic fields. We can measure directly the magnitude of the field only along the line of sight. And you have to infer information about the total field strength indirectly. Dust grain polarization. Dust grains aren't spheres. They have some irregular shape. They spin. There are mechanisms which can align the spin axis with the magnetic field. Alex Lazarian has put a lot of work into that, and we'll talk about that. But clearly, in this case, you'll get more emission perpendicular to the field than parallel. And so you get linear polarization perpendicular to B, which enables you to map the morphology of the field. Now, one thing that's important is, let's suppose you're looking along a line of sight and you have a bunch of clumps, perhaps turbulent eddies, for example, with different magnetic field directions. People often refer to the polarization maps that are produced as magnetic vectors, but they absolutely are not vectors. They do not combine vectorally. They're line segments, which give you information about the degree of polarization and the direction of the field. Let's take a case where you have two clumps along the line of sight. In one case, the field, and hence the linear polarization, is in this direction, and the other case is in that direction. And you average those together because they're along the line of sight. You don't get some kind of an average polarization like that. What you get is whichever one of these dominates, whichever one has the highest polarized flux, the direction of the line segment you measure will be in that direction. And all the only effect of this will be to reduce its amplitude. So that has an important consequence, because if you have a cloud which has a lot of turbulent eddies with magnetic field directions and all sorts of random things, what you will measure is the magnetic field direction in whatever clump dominates the polarized flux. So you can actually determine whether or not the field has a lot of scatter due to a lot of different clumps along the line of sight. It doesn't just all average out to zero and you only see the uniform field.
Dick, I'm thinking about that, so I agree with what you did there, but if I have the polarization that's coming out of the plane of the screen, then wouldn't I start being able to actually, would they combine vectorally then?
Well.
In other words, if I have one here and then one at 90 degrees, what do I see?
You mean I don't quite understand. You want to talk about some kind of polarization in this direction?
Yeah, and then when
that doesn't produce linear polarization. That magnetic field in this direction doesn't produce linear polarization.
I thought you were looking at it. Oh, I'm sorry. Where am I? Oh, you're looking.
These two. I couldn't draw it this way, but this is in front of that one.
I'm sorry. Okay.
This is what I mean by that. There is an indirect way to measure field strengths or estimate them, derived by Chandrasekhar and Fermi many years ago, and it's very simple to derive this. If you just start with the expression for the Alphane speed and ignore these deltas. And you imagine a magnetic field in this direction, and you perturb it because of, for example, turbulence or Alphane waves or whatever, such that you have a field line which looks like that. It has a delta B component, so there's an angle between the uniform field and the perturbed field. Then here's the velocity perturbation, here's the magnetic field perturbation. This assumes effectively incompressible turbulence because there's not a perturbation on delta. If you assume that this is a small angle and just do algebra, you come up with this result without this factor right here. Now, you can measure this by simply measuring the linear polarization over a cloud, determine the dispersion of position angles, and get this number. You can't determine the dispersion in velocity in the plane of the sky. You can determine it along the line of sight by measuring the width of line profiles. And so this is not exactly completely compatible with what you'd like. Various people have done studies using simulations to see whether this actually works. And the consensus is more or less that if you put a fake factor of 0.5 in front of this, that for small perturbations, this yields about the right result. By about, I mean within perhaps of order of factor 2. So it's useful, but it doesn't give the precise results that the Zeeman effect does. Okay, so that's how we can determine things. Now, before I start talking about star formation and molecular clouds, there's a kind of a recent couple of results, which I'm very curious about, which I want to describe to you and see if theorists have any ideas about this. The very first paper I ever published in my graduate career was a study of a huge cloud in the more or less direction of the galactic center, covering a huge range of galactic longitude and latitude. Its distance is about 125 parsecs, and it's detected by seeing self-absorption against brighter background hydrogen emission. So we mapped this and discussed it with a resolution of 20 arc minutes. McClure, Griffiths, and others used the Australia telescopes, the Australia Compact Array, plus the Parkes telescope to study this object with full UV sampling. And they found that it breaks up into these very fine little filaments, all nicely parallel with one another. Optical polarization data show that the magnetic field direction is like that. These things are like 17 parsecs long by less than a tenth of a parsec in diameter. They're not really resolved. And they argued that if these filaments or fingers or whatever are magnetically dominated, the field strength has to be greater than about 30 microgauss. There's one relevant measurement of the field. Some time ago, we measured the Zeeman effect toward a very distant H2 region W22, and it happens to lie right here. So it's just off of their particular map, but it's certainly well within the range where this cloud is seen, and this is the result. This is OH, so there's two OH lines. This is the cold gas seen in absorption. Here's the Stokes V profile. If you fit DID nu to that, this is the residual, and you get 18 microgauss. Now, this is the plane, this is the line of sight component of the field. It's only one of the three components. But it's certainly highly suggestive that the field in this region is strong enough for these filaments to be magnetically dominated. Just why, even if that's the case, you get things that you can see, why you have this, you know, almost corrugation structure in the plane of the sky is unclear to me, but perhaps some of you might.
Can you in two words say why they estimate the B to be larger than 30 micrograms? What's the argument?
You more or less know the kinetic temperature, so you can calculate the thermal energy. You can measure the line width, and so you can calculate the turbulent energy. And they're just comparing energy. So if the magnetic energy density dominates the kinetic energy density, that's the kind of field strength you need.
If this is a particular velocity,
yes.
Does the field morphology change with velocity significantly?
You mean like if you looked over here and looked at optical polarization?
No, in this one field, if you just change the velocity.
Oh. Well, you only measure the field is measured by dust polarization, so you don't have any velocity information. They use stars, which are close, within 200 parsecs, so they're actually sampling. They're sure they're sampling this gas. But there's not much between us and this wall of cold gas, so it's quite clear that optical polarization is referring to this gas.
So what kind of densities are we talking about?
They estimate the densities in these filaments as a few hundred.
And the argument it's magnetically dominated is just from looking at those filaments and saying
exactly.
They're
mm-hmm.
bad.
Yep. And the fact that the magnetic field is known to be in the along the long axis of the filament, and that, of course, we know that the line of sight field is comparable with what you need to do that. Now, the same kind of thing. Sorry.
I was wondering if you could explain. I guess I don't understand that image that you had up a moment ago.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
this is the self-absorption hydrogen line at this velocity, which is where the cold hydrogen maximizes in strength. And so if you look at this over here, the velocity is a little bit closer to 6. They're over where they are, it's at 5, but the velocity kind of varies between about 4 and 7 over this extended region. So this is a map. Well, actually, if you look at this, what they're mapping is this self-absorption feature right here. They determine the H1 emission profile, and they subtract that off, so they have what amounts to an absorption profile, and then they map that. And so this is basically line optical depth, the strength of the hydrogen line.
I don't think it's the emission profile, because this is such a big area.
Well, they used the Parkes telescope, single dish, to map the whole region, and then produced a map which is fully UV sampled over that whole area. It's a very extensive project that they carried out to do this. So they're sensitive to the...
Do you have a polarization map for this region?
They didn't publish one. They just stated that they compared this with some polarization data, and the polarization... optical polarization vectors over this region were in that direction on average, but they just stated that they didn't overplot them. However, I'll show you an overplot of another region. This is a CO map of Taurus. It covers a quite large area. This is 4 degrees. And you see the well-known Taurus molecular cloud clumps and complexes and so forth within the overall region. These are optical polarization line segments. So in the plane of the sky, the magnetic field here is more or less in this direction. It has some structure. In some places, it's along the minor axis of these filaments or whatever they are. In some places, it's not quite that. But up in here, you probably can't see any CO emission there, or not very much. So I'm going to zoom in on that right now. And that's what the CO, 12 CO emission looks like in that region. You see the same kind of threads or filaments. These, they then have overplotted the optical polarization. And so the magnetic field is along these filaments. They haven't published this yet, so they didn't do the kind of analysis that I just mentioned for the other one. But it looks like, again, you have long, skinny filaments lying along the magnetic field. And it turns out that these filaments are sort of pointing directly down onto this main concentration in the Taurus molecular cloud complex, sometimes called Hylas cloud too.
What's the strength of that field?
Not known. Okay, so that's just a kind of a side issue because I've only recently encountered this stuff and I thought it was pretty interesting.
Why is it a side issue? I mean, how on earth could that be supersonic turbulence if you know the field is that strong? That seems to me a qualitative argument completely against any supersonic. I'm just addressing the entire workshop.
Yeah. Well, actually, what we'll do is talk about whether fields are super.
I think it would. There's no problem with it being supersonic. I think it might be hard to get it to be super authentic.
Yeah. With a field strength of 20 or 30 microgauss, the field will turn out to be approximately authentic and supersonic.
Yeah, that's precisely the argument. You can reverse the question. How many do you ever see this structure in the denser region? Does that mean
therefore
the
penalty is about that? What is rho v turbulent squared versus v alphane squared?
I haven't actually.
Squared better not be much bigger than v alphane squared.
In this
because
region.
Because field lines are going to be moved around.
Yeah, right. Okay. In this particular region, you're right. But if it's magnetically dominated, obviously the offing speed...
No, I don't even mean it's magnetically dominated. I mean that...
Well, it has to be magnetically dominated if the filaments are produced by the magnetic field, right?
No, I'm not even arguing that. I'm just saying they're straight.
Yeah.
It's topology.
The notice is going into the core, the dense core. Mm-hmm. That's not straight. That has a very confused magnetic field.
Well, Colin is making a simple point.
I'm making a large scale structure. My children grind. No, I'm above the core, though. It's not true that the core field is extended.
I mean here, this is supposed to be a turbulent cloud.
Exactly. Because cores, polarizations in cores also...
I'm not caring about cores. We've been talking about clouds. Clouds are supposed to have supersonic turbulence. Clearly, this cannot be true.
No, you have to distinguish supersonic from super alphanic. It cannot be super alphanic. It can very easily be supersonic.
He means super alphanic.
Yeah, there's a huge difference between...
I mean super alphanic.
Is it strongly compressive?
Density doesn't matter in terms of supersonic.
Right.
Super
duper.
Density is not important.
This is not a typical structure of the molecular cloud.
It better not be. That's all I'm saying.
This is the structure of the lowest density region in Taurus.
Fine.
Right.
Okay.
A real issue is whether or not this kind of structure is common in these low density regions or not, because for the most part people haven't had the data that let them look for it.
Exactly.
And so it may be a lot more common than we think.
Sorry, just because I'm an amateur and
what size would you expect the turbulent structures to be in here?
There are all scales, B squared goes to L.
Yeah, but this on the small scales, the large scale magnetic field will keep it strong, because presumably the turbulence on small scales is weaker, right?
No.
When we say something super alphanic, it's the question of the large scale flows compared to the magnetic field. Once you get to small scale, generally the field has to be stronger than whatever you
It's a good qualitative argument, but not necessarily in the folklore of this particular arcane subject. That is that, you know, they claim that this Larson line width law, V squared goes, V goes as L to park or something, applies over a big range of scales. Right.
It's observed to go over, you know, three decks in length.
Oh, so what is the length scale here?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the physics?
Oh, well, let's see. This is a couple of degrees at 140 parsecs. So what is that, one part in 30? So the length of this is maybe 3 parsecs. And the width of these filaments is of order a tenth of a parsec or less than a tenth of a parsec.
Yeah, so in several parsecs, then the velocity dispersion, according to Larson's law, would be 1.5 to 2 kilometers.
Right. The line widths are that order.
Look, may I rephrase Colin's argument, because I think we're getting lost in details that are irrelevant. What he's saying, if we had superalphanic turbulence there, you wouldn't see that beautiful ordering of vectors over such a big area. They would be tangled up. One vector would be in one direction, the other neighboring would be in another direction.
I have a suggestion. We're going to have a discussion at noon, and I sent Paolo a couple of discussion questions, one of which is to talk about this. So,
please, 30 more seconds. Can you show the larger map, the one with the blue vectors? That map is very old, and you didn't need a new observation. You knew already that on even larger scale, say 20 parsec, the field is rather straight. Mm-hmm. And you would conclude, well, it's not super organic. But it was also well understood already long ago by Alyssa and others, Alyssa Buhlmann and others, that these observations, these vectors, are not simply the dense gas, because you know that for several reasons, it's well understood that you're sampling the low density gas here. And so this is just some kind of mean field of the low density gas. Now you have discovered nothing new. You discover that if you zoom in on a small region, yeah, the polarization control were right. But there is something more interesting. There are some structures that you need to understand, these filaments.
Yeah.
But from the point of view of the topology of the field, we haven't learned anything new that was not already in this map.
Right.
Whether it's new, you've learned anything new or not. But even looking at that map, I could tell
that
you.
That's what I'm saying.
In 1972, yes. Or whenever the... Wait, let me finish. Yeah. If I were a child in 1972, which unfortunately I was a little bit older than that, then I would have said that even on that scale, you couldn't have supersonic turbulence.
Yeah, but between...
No, it's not, but just telling me that...
Please stop saying supersonic. Yeah, but between... But between 72 and now, it's been well understood that this is sampling only the low density gas. And of course, the low density gas is not superalphane because the alphane velocity is b over square root of rho. So what have you discovered?
Who's got the alphane? Nobody's told me the low density gas is not superalphane. That's news to me.
The low density gas here.
Where did that come from?
Because
I thought you had superalphanic turbulence.
The other speed is b over square root of rho.
Okay, just a second. I agree with this. Why don't we let Dick continue with his talk and we can zoom this.
So what I'm going to do now is talk about some data sets that are, I think, relevant. Well, those are relevant, but are more uniform data sets that one can analyze and try to answer some of these questions about superalphanic and so forth. So molecular clouds presumably form out of neutral hydrogen clouds. Hylas and Trolland have carried out an extremely extensive survey with Arecibo. They looked at quasars scattered more or less randomly around the sky, looked at H1 absorption toward those quasars. Here's the H1 absorption line. Here's Stokes V. They see two components. They infer the magnetic field strength along the line of sight toward those components. And that's one of the major data sets for what the magnetic field is like in the, the low-density interstellar medium, but presumably the interstellar medium that gets together somehow to form molecular clouds to form stars. So it's a relevant input. When we go to higher density interstellar medium, we can use both dust polarization and the Zeeman effect. Here's a starless core observed with SCUBA. It's 100 parsecs away or so. The diameter is about 2 arc minutes. It's an ammonia core. These are dust polarization line segments, so the field is fairly uniform in that direction. These are the relevant volume and column densities for that. If you apply the Chandrasekhar-Fermi method, you get 80 microgauss for that magnetic field strength. We looked at that with the old NRAO 140-foot telescope, which has an 18 arc-minute beam, so it's vastly bigger than this. It's pointed at this core, but it's sampling a much larger area. Here's the two OH lines, Stokes V. We didn't detect the field, and so it's indicative of the field over in a much larger area being a lot weaker than it is toward this core. But notice that the column densities are different by a factor of 10. So if you had the mass to flux ratio be constant, and this number is correct, then the line of sight or the field over this area would be about 8 microgauss. Here's another example, another starless core. There are fewer points, but you get similar kind of results, more or less the same kind of regions being sampled, field strength of 140. In this case, with Arecibo, we did detect the Zeeman effect. This is OH with a 3 arc minute beam. So that's about the size of this picture over here. It may not look too great, but it's actually a 5 sigma result. You have two lines. I've only shown one here. And you get the same result in both lines, so it gives some idea that it's correct. The field here is 11 microgauss as opposed to 140, quite a large change. But again, the column densities are quite different, and the volume densities are quite different.
Well, it's not as the column is only different by a factor of 4, and the fields are different by much more.
Yeah, can I ask actually about that volume density for the Chandrasekhar-Fermi?
Yeah.
Because this goes to the point that Paolo is making, that if you're dominated, so the vector is telling you about what's giving you the most polarization, and if grain alignment is more efficient in the lower density gas than in the higher density gas, could it be that the volume density is actually, that of the gas that's giving you that effect is actually significantly lower than that?
Well, these polarization line segments are measured in dust polarization with SCUBA, and SCUBA needs a rather large column density to be able to see anything. If you are sampling, say, an envelope, and you're mainly picking up stuff out here, we would have detected the polarization out here. The reason you see that polarization is because you've got a much larger column density when you go through the core, and you don't see the polarization out here.
More generally, where does that number density estimate come from? Because yes,
it comes from taking the column density in this core averaged over this region and assuming it's more or less spherical.
Okay, yeah, I guess I'm just I'm a little concerned by the fact that, yes, as Chris pointed out, the difference in the column density is a factor of 5 or 4, and the difference in the volume density is a factor of 50.
Well, this is sampling a somewhat larger region. This volume density is relevant to where the polarization is detected.
Also, the OH-Siemens splitting is density weighted, essentially, measurements, while the other one is goes the other way. It's density canceled.
Anti-weighted.
So it should go the other way around.
One thing, though, to keep in mind is, again, this is the line of sight component of the field, and this is sensitive because it's dust polarization to plane of the sky. So you could have exactly the same field in both of these, and if the orientation were such, you could get 0 here and a large number there, or even vice versa.
Sure, but if that keeps happening, it's a little worrying.
Yeah, well. Okay, here's, so I've been saying that these polarization directions seem to be pretty uniform, and that is the case most of the time, but not all the time. So here's another starless core, again, SCUBA observations. It's very chaotic. The dispersion and position angles is 40 degrees instead of 13 degrees. This looks more like Paolo's core, and this looks more like a very strong uniform magnetic field. This case is the minority, but it's not a zero case, just to keep that in mind.
The drop in the polarization vector is towards the center of the core. Is this, as you were talking about before, you know, since these things don't add vectorally, one interprets that as being a change in direction, that there's
the drop in the length of these line segments is probably due mainly to the grains not being not producing as much polarization, change in the grain properties.
So it's really not telling anything about
that. Or a change in grain alignment. It may be that the grains, even though they may be highly polarizable, they're not aligned. There's a variety of reasons why that might be, but.
I can't infer field strength.
You cannot infer field strengths from the length of these line segments.
Other than the structure of the field, what other differences are there between these two cores?
Very little. They're both starless cores. They both have the more or less the same density. I think this one's a little farther away. It's fainter. You can see it looks a little rattier than that map.
What about the total mass?
It's comparable. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but they're both, these cores are both a few solar masses.
Is there any way to tell if they're rotating?
You can, in principle. I don't know the numbers, but in general, such cores have very low rotation rates, so energy of rotation is dominated by other things.
Are the lines comparable?
Yeah.
1498 looks less centrally taped. Mm-hmm. It hasn't gone through as much contraction, which you expect then that the central magnetic field is not as high.
That's certainly possible. But you can't infer a field strength from this because this larger dispersion means the Chandrasekhar-Fermi method is just not viable.
Yeah, but a large dispersion also implies that, you know, maybe
the field is probably weaker. That's right. Uh-huh. Again, though, it may be that in this object the field is primarily pointing towards you because this stuff is sensitive to the field in the plane of the sky. That's always a problem we have with these kind of data. Well, let's move on to an object that's already formed a protostar. These are BIMA observations, and these green line segments show the dust polarizations, which means that the magnetic field here is pointed in that direction. There's even some hint of an hourglass morphology if you draw lines perpendicular to that. I'll show you better in a moment. But what I really wanted to show was the CO outflow. So there's a CO outflow, which is more or less north-south, close in. These line segments show the direction of the field inferred from the Chandrasekhar-Fermi method, linear polarization of the CO line in the outflow. Clearly, the CO outflow doesn't start off along the magnetic field, at least projected. But as you go out, these are the same data, but they're just reduced differently to emphasize signal-to-noise versus resolution. As you go farther out, this outflow seems to change direction and go more or less along the direction of the field. And that direction of the field out here is the same as the direction of the field in here. So this is the only example we have so far about what we know about magnetic field strengths directions directly in CO outflows. But ALMA should be able to clean up on this kind of a thing because it's purely a signal-to-noise limited kind of a study. This is that same object imaged with the SMA at higher frequency. It's a binary And what they've done is they've rotated the dust polarization vector, so that these line segments outline the magnetic field direction. You see a very uniform direction of the field, except for what appears to be an hourglass-type morphology. They claim their sampling density is up to about 10 to the 7, and the Chandrasekhar-Fermi method gives field strengths of about 2 milligauss.
And which, going back is the old version of that?
Yeah. But
look at that again? That's on a bigger scale.
This guy right here. Well, the scale is here, but the resolution is lower than they have, and because this is 1 millimeter instead of, well.
Did you get the same answer?
Same answer, yeah. The field direction lies like that, or like that. And we see a hint of this morphology, but they really nail it. And it's one can perhaps compare that with this model that Muscovius and colleagues had of a core. It looks, you know, you have this pinch to the magnetic field that looks very much like that. Okay.
Hmm?
Yeah, even the colors. You can also use instruments like.
When you were making that comparison, were the light scales the same for the theory and the observation?
I haven't checked that, but they should be roughly correct.
Shouldn't the core be flattened or perpendicular to the field?
Shouldn't the core be flattened? Well, this actually is not a single disk. It's actually known to be sort of a binary. And so it's not a direct comparison with that.
But that's not true.
But it also may not be, you know, it may not be viewed like that. It may be viewed like that.
But what is the size of the beam on the right image?
Oh, I see, yes.
Pardon?
What is the size of the beam on the right image?
Oh, I don't recall exactly, but I think it's less than an arc second. So here's one arc second. I seem to recall it was about half to 3/4 of an arc second. So about the size of that, maybe a little smaller than that inner white contour right there. Okay, you can also use interferometers to map magnetic fields. This is an example of a result from the VLA. This is NGC 2024. It's a beautiful optical H2 region, sometimes called the Flame Nebula. It has a dense molecular cloud in front of it. These black lines are C18O, and these are regions where Metzger, many years ago, claimed that he was seeing protostars with densities of 10 to the 7 or more, 10 to the 8. Here's the Zeeman effect in absorption. The two lines, you see very strongly detected Zeeman effect. You get the same answer for these two. This one looks like a weaker Zeeman effect, but this line has an intrinsically weaker Zeeman effect by a factor of 2. And this is a map of the field. So line of sight field goes from approximately 0 over here to about 100 micrograss here. These are dust polarization line segments. The magnetic field is perpendicular to that. And so it sort of looks like the field is in some sense wrapping around this filament. Now these sample different regions. These guys sample higher densities than this OH. But still, it gives an idea of the kind of data that are available. That's all I'm trying to do. These examples. Finally, to sample high densities, one can use the CN line, and this is an example of that. There's 7 strong hyperfine components. They all have different Zeeman splitting Zs, and so you analyze these by analyzing them all simultaneously. Here's the sum of the Stokes I parameter profiles for the 4 of these 7 that have strong Zeeman splitting. Here's Stokes V, and here's the fit to that. What we actually did in this particular case is fit 2 Gaussians to this and infer the magnetic field strength separately. And there's some hint that maybe there's a field there. But the main thing is that there's a field detected in this component right here. By the way, we've done a test of how good this kind of Zeeman fitting is by producing line profiles in a computer with 2 components and putting noise and so forth and so on. And it's very reliable down to about the 2 sigma level. So I wouldn't claim a 1 sigma detection, even with Gaussian statistics, it's not a very solid thing. But at the 2 sigma level, we're quite confident that the Gaussian probabilities apply. That is, that you have a very strong chance that a 2 sigma result is real. Okay, so what I'm about to do is then analyze a series of major Zeeman data sets that H1 study toward quasars. There was an earlier study we carried out with the Greenbank 140-foot telescope toward dark clouds, an 18 arc-minute beam pointed toward cores, but because of the large beam, you're mainly not sampling the core. Only 2 out of 12 detections. Tom Tolden and I have just completed a study of dark cloud cores at Arecibo, a 3 arc-minute beam. This, by the way, involved about 1,000 hours of telescope time, and this is about 700, just to give you an idea of just how twilight-like these kind of studies are. But we got a large number of detections. Objects that are detected with single dish are often mapped to the VLA, and there's about every one of those is already detected because you don't map it with the VLA until you know you have a detection. These are the ERAM CN results we have so far. And then at Bonn, they detected an excited state OH line and absorption toward W3OH and used it to determine the field. The ground state OH lines are in the J equals 3/2 state. This was 2 rotational levels above that, 200 Kelvin above the ground state, where the density has to be very high. And they got one result. So this isn't one out of one because they didn't try to measure the Zeeman effect in others. It's just other objects they looked for. They didn't see that line in absorption. It's mainly in Maser emission. So this is the results from all of that plotted linearly. This goes from 0 microgauss to 4,000 microgauss plotted against volume density. And there's several things you can see about this. First, at high volume densities, the fields tend to be relatively large. These are the CN results. This is that excited OH result. Below about 10 to the 4, at least on this scale, the field looks like it's 0. This kind of anomalous looking object is Sagittarius B2, which is the most massive giant molecular cloud in the galaxy. It's very anomalous, 10 to the 7 approximately solar masses, very wide winelets and so forth. So I didn't actually use that point in any of the analysis because it's a unique object. Well, you can't tell much about what's going on down here on this kind of a plot. So if you plot it logarithmically here, you can see a little bit more what's going on. So again, these are the OH data, the H1 data, mainly the OH data and the CN data. Now, most of these points are not detections. As you could see in that table I showed you a moment ago, in the majority of cases, you have measurements, which are good solid measurements. They're just not detections. Right here, for example, the so-called measured value is 2/10 of a microgauss, but that constrains the field at the 1 sigma level to be less than about 2 microgauss. So this is a significant result, even though it's not a detection. The line of sight component of the field is a lower limit to the total field strength. So one thing you could imagine doing is just taking the upper envelope of this, and you'd get a field strength which goes sort of something like that, maybe. But that makes the assumption that every one of these objects has the same total field strength, and that the reason you have some measurements down here is because the field doesn't lie along the line of sight. So there's a better way you can try to analyze these data, and this is a little bit tedious, but I want to briefly talk about it. And that is to look at the probability density function of the total field strength. In the case that in a given regime, all the field strengths, total field strengths are the same, that's just a delta function. Another possibility is that the fields vary from some maximum value uniformly down to zero. And then imposed upon this is the fact that even for an object which lies right here, if the field is in the plane of the sky, you'll observe 0 line of sight magnetic field strength. So these are the various possible distributions of the strength of the total field, either everything the same or uniform or some other kinds of shape. And you can then use that to say what you will observe. So that's what this is. The delta function, for example, has this kind of a shape when you measure the line of sight component. If the field points exactly at you, you'll observe the correct field strength. But if the field is exactly in the plane of the sky, you'll observe 0. And projection effects will cause this to distribute uniformly. The flat one, where the fields varied from some maximum down to 0, has this kind of a shape. But one thing that's important about all this is that the median value of all of these is very close to 1/2. What that means is that independent of the intrinsic distribution of magnetic field strengths, if you take an ensemble and assume that the field directions are random, you can use a factor of two correction to go from the median line of sight magnetic field strength to the total magnetic field strength. You can also, though, test data and see. This is a result, a similar probability density function from a super alphanic simulation, which Alex Lazarian gave me. It's a Mach number 2, and it just shows basically the probability density function of observing different magnetic fields. This is the total field, how they're distributed. So there's a long tail where there's some strong fields, and it looks sort of intermediate between a delta function, this kind of a flat distribution that I talked about a moment ago. Paolo gave me a similar kind of thing, but he did it in a different way, and our code isn't set up yet to analyze that, but it'll be done later. So what we've done is a Bayesian analysis of all of these data. That is, you use Monte Carlo techniques to predict what you should observe, compare it with what you get, and then you can compare different intrinsic distributions. For H1, the unique, that is, delta function as compared with the uniform, that is, the field varying from some maximum value to zero uniformly, you can't tell the difference with the data that exists between those two possible distributions. This happens to be the so-called posterior for the unique one. It says that the magnetic field strength is 6. If you did the same thing as we did for the uniform case, it would say that the field is distributed uniformly between 0 and about 11. Again, the median is the same in both cases, about 5 or 6.
What are the axes on that plot?
Probability versus maximum likelihood for the value you're trying to infer. In this case, the assumption is made that all the total field strengths in those H1 clouds are the same, and that the reason for that distribution is simply projection effect.
Okay.
And so what is that unique total field strength?
Okay.
And it's of order 6 micrograms.
Okay.
Do the same thing for the OH objects, and you get a rather different result. This is the unique or delta function versus that Lazarian simulation versus the uniform case. And pretty much the unique single value is ruled out. These are the ratio of the probabilities. This is actually the result for the uniform case. This is the maximum value of that uniform case. So the fields would be distributed between 0 and this maximum value. This is not very well determined, obviously, but the median is about 14 or 15 in this case. So
you're getting these terribly small numbers of 2 times minus 8.
That's just it's entirely unnormalized.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And so comparing that with what you get for a different intrinsic distribution, you can compare those probabilities, and that's what this is. But exactly what those numbers are just depends on fundamentally how you've done the Monte Carlo thing, and if you do it a different way, you'll get very different numbers there.
Usually you normalize.
Yeah, this is just unnormalized.
But your prior, your Bayesian is the distribution?
Yeah, you assume a distribution, for example, a delta function. All the fields are the same, and you ask whether or not the data are consistent with that.
Okay, that's not the way I
do it. This, by the way, this analysis is done by my colleague at Illinois, Ben Vendelt, who's a cosmologist. He's on the Planck team and has developed these techniques for analyzing CMB data.
Right, but usually what you put in priors is what you know.
Yeah, but here I assume
it's a different approach.
They always have flat priors, right? They don't know anything. They don't assume they have prior knowledge.
So here's the data again, and this is what one gets from this kind of analysis, that the median value at low densities is about 6 micrograss. The median value in the OH case is about 14. It doesn't look like this what this is saying is that the field is distributed uniformly, the total field, between 0 and about 30. What I'd like to test is whether or not what really is going on is that at this point the field starts going up like that. A distribution, something like that. And this actually, that case, which is B proportional to the square root of density, is running right now. I was hoping he'd finish before the talk, but he didn't. But maybe he'll have finished, and I can tell you the result of that this afternoon. If you put that kind of a stuff, though, on the log plot, this is what you would get. This is a b proportional to n to the 1/2. And it's consistent with the analysis that the field, intrinsic field, is uniform between some maximum value and zero, because that didn't take into account the volume densities. The thing that's running now will take into account the volume densities and see if this is what's most probable. But it, all it really does is pick a point here between the, the H and the OH and say that it goes as n to the 1/2, the same median value, and it certainly looks consistent. And this is just an extension of that. This analysis has not yet been done either, but it sort of is consistent with the field varying as density to the 1/2, starting right about there. So this table is the sort of grand result of all of this. H1 clouds, OH clouds, CN clouds. Kinetic temperatures, median column densities, median volume densities. From those two, you can get the thickness. This is the non-thermal velocity dispersions, the median total field strength in each case. From all this, you can calculate the sonic Mach number, the Alphanic Mach number, and from column density and field, you can calculate the mass-to-flux ratio with respect to that critical value. So what does this mean? Well,
what is the temperature? The CN clouds are molecular.
Yeah.
Why are they so warm?
Because they are in regions where you are, they're GMC cores where the temperatures are higher.
You must have massive star formation.
Massive star formation.
Okay, those are massive star forming cores that have been heated by the central star. Okay.
Right. So, within the uncertainties, all of these sonic Mach numbers are the same and suggest that that sonic Mach number, ranging from low-density H1 clouds all the way up to high-density molecular cloud cores, is about 4 or 5.
Are those 1D or 3D Mach numbers?
They're 3D.
Okay.
That is, 1D is measured. Oh, and that's a little bit of an uncertainty, because I've assumed that the line of sight line width is, let me say it another way, that the turbulence is isotropic. If you want to say that it's not, then you would change that a little bit.
Okay, those are 3D, assuming it's isotropic.
Right.
Okay.
The Alphanic Mach numbers are all about the same, too. There's not, the difference between this number, this number, and this number is not significant, given the uncertainties in all this. So it's getting an Alphanic Mach number of about 2. And there's a great difference between mass to flux ratios. These H1 clouds are highly subcritical. This is, again, a median value. And these guys, again, these numbers are the same, but it says that the mass-to-flux ratio is somewhere between critical and a factor of 2 supercritical. Now, there are two...
Nick, when you do the mass-to-flux ratio there, sometimes people make a correction for the column density also.
Yep, that's just what I was about to say. Well, first let me show you how this all plots up. If you were to take each individual data point and just correct by this factor of 2, which is only statistically correct. It's not really correct for any individual object. This is how the run of these things go. But there is this correction you just mentioned. If clouds are spherical, then you get the same column density however you look through it. But if they're disk, then when you look along the line of sight, you'll measure a larger column density than you want. You really want the column density along the magnetic field. And so you get too much column density, and so that leads to a larger mass-to-flux ratio than is reality. And so that amounts to a correction of about a factor of 2. It depends. I mean, this is for a uniform disk. If you worry about real disk and so forth, you get a number a little bit different from 2. In this figure, that correction has been made. That's what this lambda corrected means. And the numbers in that table, I haven't done any correction yet. So you get, you know, roughly a factor of critical up here, and subcritical, perhaps varying like this, but this is very uncertain. The median value is actually right about there.
So, I mean, we should be able to just look at these things and know if they are flattened disks. I mean, morphologically, I would guess I'd say that the, you know, the low density things like the H1 clouds you showed us certainly looked highly flattened to me.
Yeah,
whereas the high density things generally look pretty round. So.
No, the cores are flattened too.
Well, I mean, they're not.
but they're not thin disks. I mean, they have
In any case, the magnitude of this correction is comparable with the uncertainty in the measurement. So you shouldn't take, when I say that they tend to be super alphanic by a factor of 2, that doesn't mean they're not alphanic or super alphanic by a factor of 4. And the kind of correction we're talking about here is less than 2.
I
wouldn't home in on that too.
Just pointing out that, I mean, there's an obvious difference in morphology between the low density things and the high density things. Just from looking at the maps.
The morphology of the cores, we've shown that are consistent with flattened objects, oblate.
Flattened oblate, but not flat.
So there's flattened in the sense that they are not round.
Right, but then you don't get the factor 2, it's intermediate.
This factor of 2 is a sort of an upper limit to the kind of correction you want to make for the
filamentary. Were elongated, we made it feel in the direction of the longer axis, then the correction will go the other way around.
That's right.
Yeah, but they are not consistent with filaments. The observations are not consistent.
The low-density class.
You don't know.
I can show you my paper later.
No, but I'm still talking about the data, not the paper. But in these 50 data points, you don't know what is the relative orientation of the major axis of the magnetic of the cores and the magnetic field. So really, you don't know in which direction the correction goes. It could be one direction or the other. So there's no point in taking a correction.
But if you look at cores, any kind of data set you want for cores, they are consistent with oblate objects, not filament.
It doesn't matter. The point is, what is the relative orientation of B with the major axis of the core? And you don't know it for this sample. So as simple as that.
No,
These guys, as I said, are the ones that presumably end up forming molecular clouds. And so this says that those the H1 clouds are highly subcritical. There's no suggestion that you evolve from here to here via ambipolar diffusion, because the column densities here are very, very low, to a median value of 10 to the 20. What probably, in my opinion, is going on is you have a number of H1 clouds in a flux tube. When you observe, you're looking along a particular line of sight, and so you observe the mass in that clump and the magnetic field in that clump. But if you form molecular clouds by flows along magnetic field lines, if these two were to combine, you'd double the mass, but you wouldn't change the magnetic field at all. So I think the most likely explanation for what's going on here is that this is measuring a small amount of mass in the flux tube. There's other mass in that flux tube. And if all that mass gets together into one high-density clump, you can end up with a roughly critical core. But this doesn't imply ambipolar diffusion direct evolution from here to here.
Dick, so that nobody misunderstands, nobody has suggested that ambipolar diffusion would do that, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to make it clear.
Nestle said this 40 years ago.
Okay, now, before I talk about this, let me go back a bit. What theorists like Chris McKee would like is to look at an entire, say, GMC or an entire torus region, and to have me tell him over that entire region, are the motions alphanic or super alphanic? Is the mass to flux ratio critical or subcritical? The reason you can't do that is, if you remember that image of torus, most of the volume is this low density stuff where you just barely detect the CO line anyway, and the OH lines are much weaker still. If you look at a core in torus, and many of those Arecibo results were cores in torus, and then it takes about 10 hours to get the results we got. If you go out into the boonies, where the line is 10 times weaker, just do the math, it'll take 1,000 hours per position. So suppose I did that. Suppose I picked a point out there and did one measurement, 1,000 hours to get a result. Are you going to believe that that applies to the entire cloud? Are you going to believe that that's representative of all clouds? I don't think so.
You don't need to. You know, the loss in scaling motion, so you just use that.
Okay. There is a better way to do it, though.
Except that it's gospel by this word.
Well, okay. But
so
I think there is a definitive test, at least, of this ambipolar diffusion-driven model. And the definitive test is based on the following. This model absolutely requires that the mass-to-flux ratio change like this as you go from low density to high density. Right? It has to be going up. There's no way around that in this model. If you can't, if you can prove that that isn't what's happening, that model is wrong. In simulations, you often get it going the other direction. These are some simulations by these guys, but you may recall Ralph Pudwitz on Monday when he gave his talk, said he got that same result, that the mass to flux ratio actually goes opposite direction. So how can we determine that? Well, what we're doing right now at Greenbank, we've gotten somewhere between 200 and 300 hours. And by the way, what I'm hoping for is really bad weather, unlike a typical astronomer, because the way they schedule that telescope is they give us backup time, and when the weather's bad, I get to observe at 1 gigahertz. And when the weather's good, the 20 gigahertz guys get to observe and do, you know, waste telescope time looking for CO and infrared galaxies and things like that. So I'm hoping for bad weather, and if so, I'll get the full 300 hours. The idea is to measure the differential mass to flux ratio. We look at a point, a core we observed with Arecibo, and we have a detection of the magnetic field along the line of sight in that direction. At Greenbank, with a bigger beam, we put down four beams surrounding that to sample the envelope around this core. That takes out several things. You're sampling in the same species, and you're also, if the magnetic field is at some angle along the line of sight, then on average, at least if the field is strong, it's going to be at that same angle from the envelope to the core. That's why we look at all four directions. So the differential mass to flux ratio is from the core to the envelope. This just gives the column density or mass. This is what you can measure with the Zeeman effect. And you look to see whether or not the differential mass to flux ratio now goes up as you go from the envelope to the core. It doesn't matter what the absolute values are. It's the differential. The absolute values can be wrong because of line of sight effects.
Would you also observe the center one with the Greenbank to make sure that the Greenbank to Arecibo data are consistent?
You could do that, but the Greenbank beam would be quite large, and these Zeeman effects are intrinsically differential. That is, the only thing that counts is the ratio of Stokes I to Stokes V. So you can make the measurement with no calibration whatsoever. It's only the ratio of those two that matters.
So the flux density.
The flux density itself doesn't matter. It's only the ratio of the two that is important for the Zeeman effect. Sometimes we've actually observed without even bothering to turn on a noise diode or something. And only look at the differential. So this is one of the objects we're looking at. This is a core detected at Arecibo. Here's the two OH lines. This histogram is the Stokes V, and that darker line is a fit to it. And in this case, the 1667 line, we get 25, 1665, we get 28. They're quite consistent, even though the intrinsic Zeeman splitting factors are different by a factor of 2. And it may look kind of ratty, but these are 5 sigma detections. It almost is certainly the case in this line that there are multiple components. You see a sharp edge here, and there's probably another component here, another here, maybe another here. And you may actually be seeing that in the Zeeman effect, because notice this fits very well on this side, but not very well on that side, because the slope is too small. The real slope of this component is probably sharper, which would cause this to fit better. And the data suggests that it goes down here, possibly due to a Zeeman component right there. So one could do, you know, a Gaussian deconvolution of that and do all that kind of stuff, drive fields separately for the two components. But for our purposes, it doesn't matter. We can measure quite accurately the field in this component. This next picture.
What are the prospects for being able to, if you had absorption lines, then you could separate out all those components?
Sure.
Is it possible to ever get absorption spectra so you can see what the structure is?
Well, you can certainly get absorption spectra, not in general toward dark cloud cores, because none of them happens to lie in front of a continuum source. Mm-hmm. This shows an Arecibo map of this object. Here's the center position. You can see this is going every 3 arc minutes, and you can see how the line strength falls off. So this is 6 arc minutes away. The line is down to less than half strength. So you're going from this core into the envelope. Where we're pointing at Arecibo is these positions, at Greenbank, are these positions right here. And it obviously is a bigger beam, so it'll encompass this kind of stuff. Here there's almost no line at all. But we observe that in any case, just so we have sampling of all the way around. So we actually are going out into the envelope. The line, the column density is down by a factor of at least 2. And with 50 hours of observing time per envelope, which is how much we need to do this, we will detect the magnetic, if the magnetic field strength is the same in the envelope and the core, we'll detect it with the same signal-to-noise ratio. But, so with 300 hours, we'll be able to do 6 cores, and I think be able to make a definitive test of this ambipolar diffusion model. If we see the mass to flux ratio going up in the core, it's consistent with that model. If we don't see it going up in the core, or if we see it going down, then my opinion is we can rule out that model.
Don't you already have that data for the Barnard 1? Are you going to talk about it?
No, I wasn't, but Barnard 1 is an object where we observed with Arecibo, and we observed exactly the same position with the Greenbank 1 40-foot telescope. So the beam sizes are 13 and 18 arc minutes in diameter. So the 18 arc minute diameter samples a lot of the envelope. And so I actually did that calculation for that. And it is suggestive but not definitive that the mass to flux ratio is going up toward the core. But it's the signal to noise is. The problem is that even though the Greenbank 140-foot beam is 18 arc minutes, more than half of the signal is still dominated by the core. And so it's kind of hard to be sure exactly how to deconvolve that without a detailed map, which we don't have. But with this experiment that's underway right now, the core is excluded from the Greenbank beams in all cases, so you don't have that complication. So that's suggestive, but it's not, in no way is that definitive. Okay, so I think there's hope for the future, and by a border next April, we'll finish this Greenbank run, and I can tell you what the answer to that is. And we're going to do some more of these statistical studies of distribution functions. Again, Paolo gave me some stuff which is in a slightly different form, and so that can be tested against this too. We just haven't done that yet. So let me conclude with showing you this poster, which is on my office door. There's going to be a conference in March on magnetic fields in the galaxy, entire conference devoted just to that. And so if you're interested in magnetic fields in the galaxy, the interstellar medium in the galaxy, you're invited to come to that meeting. Thanks. So for discussion purposes, it might be not a bad idea to put this table back up.
There's a question. In the data that you had in 1999 that Shantanu analyzed, you got a median Alfvén Mach number of 1.0. And I was just wondering what has changed.
Those data are included in this column, but there's just a lot more data. Moreover, there only detections were analyzed, but the non-detections were ignored. Here, this analysis considers all the measurements, whether they're detections or not.
And my recollection is that by using the medians, though, at least in the data that you had, more than half of the data were detected, so that then by using the median, it was included in the non-detections, but they didn't figure in the sophisticated amount of collapse that you're doing now.
No, actually what was done was to take only the detections and then multiply the mean by a factor of 2. And the non-detections were not considered.
Yeah, well, maybe I redid it.
Oh, maybe you redid it.
Yeah, from just looking at it, but from your 99 paper.
It's also the case that in that 1999 paper, all available results were not listed. There were non-detections, which I just didn't consider. Yeah. But it's become more clear that you can't just ignore the non-detections. You have to take them into account because they do provide meaningful input into the field strengths, and you have to do it with an analysis similar to this Bayesian analysis. Although, again, the probability density function shape always seems to yield a median of about half. So, zeroth order, you can just take the median LOS line of sight field strength, including the measurements which aren't detections, and multiply by 2, and you'll get the median. You won't know anything about the distribution. Every single magnetic field may have that strength, or they vary from 0 to some value, one or twice that big, or 3 or 4 times that big, depending upon the shape.
The other interesting thing, which I noticed from your data, was that the median temperature in your sample was 40 Kelvin. And now I hadn't, but you hadn't broken it down that way. And you didn't have, in that table, you were just doing molecular clouds. So you didn't have the H1.
It had some H1 clouds where we think the H1, H1 absorption with the VLA, where it was clear that the H1 was actually sampling very dense gas. And in some cases, there were OH data also, which often gave about the same results. For example, toward Orion A, the so-called veil. In OH and H1, you get about the same magnetic field strength.
But in the temperature of 50, is that, this includes emission results as well as absorption results.
This guy?
Yeah.
Oh, this is only that Arecibo Millennium survey. The Zeeman analysis is done on absorption lines seen toward quasars. They get the temperature by looking off the quasar, seeing the line in emission, and that gives you the line optical depth and the line spin temperature separately. And then they get the median value of that spin temperature. That's how that's done.
That's higher than the temperature that you were using. And the ones that you included in your table in 99, you would have had. If you're looking at very dense regions, the temperature presumably.
Right, exactly. Yep. And some of these numbers are very uncertain. For example, this number is well determined, and this number is well determined, but the volume density in this case is determined by assuming that the mean interstellar pressure is 3,000. And so you can go from a temperature of 50 and a pressure of 3,000 to that number. And this thickness is then determined by comparing these two numbers. They're done in different ways. In OH clouds, the size, this, by the way, is the equivalent of a diameter, but I didn't call it a diameter because that suggests they're spheres. So that's the thickness along the line of sight. This is done by mapping the OH, finding the half power point, and then saying that the cloud has the same thickness along the line of sight as that half power point. What's done here is to take the best possible way that I can that you can get these parameters.
All of them have been mapped, so for all of them, this is the case.
Yeah, with the Arecibo stuff, we did again because you take 10 hours to do the Zeeman result, we can do the mapping in 5 minutes to get what we need for that purpose. So it's trivial to do the mapping. But people who like. One reason, by the way, there's some important data which aren't included in this analysis, and that's this study by Tyler Bork and collaborators, which is an entirely OH absorption line study. But they don't have any information. They have the magnetic field, either measurements or limits, but they don't have any information about the extent of the clouds or anything like that. And it's hard to get that information for a pure absorption line study. So it's interesting information about field strength distributions. And if you're going to do this Bayesian analysis and not consider the volume density or anything else, you can include those data, but you don't have the full kind of data sets that you have with most of these others.
But regarding the size, if we had to refer to the mean field that you measure with the Zeeman splitting within that beam, related to the size, wouldn't be more meaningful to actually have the size of the beam? Because it could be that the core is larger than your beam, and then you give a size that is larger than the beam, but in reality you pick the magnetic field only in the central region of that larger size, right? If the beam is smaller than that size, I mean. Well, you haven't used it, so it doesn't matter. But if you had to use.
I mean, this is a typical case. The beam size. These maps are separated by 3 arc minutes, which is the beam size. So you know, this core is at half power is sort of, you know, this kind of a size. It's slightly bigger than the beam, but not very much bigger. In some cases, the cores are not resolved. They're smaller than the beam, in which case you take we take the beam size as a limit to that.
So the sizes are not so far from the beam anyway, you're saying?
Yeah, the sizes in Taurus, the cores tend to be, you know, 2 to 4 or 5 arc minutes in diameter. There's typical kind of, well, they're typical ammonia cores. These were selected, by the way, on the basis of looking at people's maps of CO and so forth in Taurus and other regions and picking peaks. And then we look there because that's where you, there's no other bias other than that we're looking at peaks or cores. We haven't you know, tried to bias the selections in any other way. And so because those cores are typically, you know, a couple of arc minutes across in Taurus, that couples very well with the beam. OH samples lower density than ammonia, so these OH cores are bigger. They're not They're not the 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5 density cores that you see sometimes in ammonia or in the dust. They're a little bigger than that. At 10 to the 5, because of chemistry, OH tends to go away a little bit. We've tried looking at CN in some of these starless cores in order to try to measure the, by the Zeeman effect, the magnetic field in the core at a density of 10 to the 5, but the lines are all very weak, the ones we've looked at so far. So if somebody would give us 1,000 hours on the ERAM 30 meter or equivalent, we'd be able to do the same thing for higher density regions. So I don't know, that comes back to the point I made before, that if life were fair, we'd get all but 1 hour per year of observing time on telescopes, because that would then give the same sensitivity to the magnetic field that people who want to map just Stokes' eye have. But unfortunately, tacks tend to want to go the other way. We fight for 50 hours of observing time per year instead of 10,000.
Well, yes, I can't understand why that is. If they think you can't get a conclusive answer, or what?
Oh, just all these other people who think that other kinds of astrophysics are important. I mean, I don't understand it either, but that's what TACs seem to think.
Can you make a special telescope to do this?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, actually.
Why don't you propose that?
In fact, if the Greenbank 140-foot were still available, that's a pretty good telescope because it has a large beam. So even if you do point at a core, you're mainly sampling the envelope.
Telescopes aren't that expensive. Why don't you actually go say, I want to...
Well, considering how important the problem is, I think, especially.
You know, no, but I want to solve this problem. Design a telescope to do it, and then you can have the observing time for... So what is wrong with that?
You need to find a rich guy who's as excited as...
There's nothing really wrong with
it. It's not that much.
I don't know. You could probably build a sort of a 40-meter L-band-only telescope for... couple $100,000, I would
That's
guess, today.
Yeah.
And probably equip it so it had a really low noise receiver and a spectrometer might cost $500,000. I bet I could build one for $500,000.
Well, you get a lot of support if you only...
Because it doesn't need to point very well. Its surface doesn't need to be all that great.
Seems to be...
You need a very low noise receiver and a good spectrometer, but aside from that...
Look at the Sloan Digital Star. That was really kind of a one... I mean, there was a lot of ancillary science that came out of it, but there was one question they were trying to answer.
Yeah.
In some sense.
Yeah, what was it?
I'm not sure. I've been wondering that myself.
$1 million proposal supported by everybody.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, actually,
in our community, given the importance.
One of the previous workshops, which is 15, embedded WMAP. But it seems to me one of the things you could actually do is go and design the best possible
thing
to solve this problem.
The old NRAO 140-foot telescope would be an excellent telescope for this purpose. It's just that they don't allow. Free observing with that anymore.
Yeah,
you can buy observing time on it, but NRAO doesn't have the money to operate it as a...
So how much facility. Does that
cost? I don't know how much they're charging. You know how much they're charging for using that telescope? They're charging the cost of operations, and some people actually use it for that purpose. Well, it's actually higher than you
like
might think.
If you had a very large proposal supported by the bulk of the community, then it would be able to get
that. Yeah, okay. Go and be the director of NRAO.
There you go, slow digital science curve.
No, I think you submit an unsolicited proposal to Fred Lowe and say, I want to solve this problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure I know what his reaction would be. His reaction would be, okay, that's great, but I don't have the money to do it. So if you can get NSF or somebody to provide the funds separately from the NRAO budget,
well,
he'd probably say fine.
Same on theory, you know, irrelevant papers on whether
NRAO was 1.3 or 1.8. But we established earlier that theory is the cheap labor of the astronomical world.
Yeah, but it might only cost him $200,000 to do this. That's a couple of postdocs,
well,
years.
Well, you'd also need the postdocs to analyze all the data, so, and run the telescope.
Paolo can do it.
Paolo can do it, okay.
Let's bring it back, actually, as I wanted to ask Paolo, I wanted to ask you a question, because since you, like Ralph, have been doing these super authentic models, do you agree that if the experiment that Vic has just described is going to be critical, and that based on this, the outcome of the result, you will either say, see, this proves that I was right all along, or if it turns out the other way, it's not super authentic.
No.
Or do you see difficulty?
Well, I haven't done this analysis in the simulations. I don't know what the outcome of that experiment would be in the simulations, but we would definitely do it because we're actually doing now, we make a juvenile synthetic Zeeman splitting measurements, doing the full allele transfer for all the Stokes parameters. And so we will have now this type of data, and we will observe it in the same way with the same beams is used in this data.
Okay.
And so we'll be able to exactly reproduce that type of observation. So then we'll know.
Yeah.
Maybe it comes out that it's very close to the prediction of Mikulajic, in which case we won't learn anything. I don't know yet.
What?
Other.
You wouldn't learn anything?
We wouldn't learn if the observation can rule out one model or the other. Yeah. The observation wouldn't be able to rule out one model or the other.
If they have the same prediction.
Or they could rule out both models.
Other simulations seem to produce this kind of result, though, and so I assume yours probably will, too.
Yeah,
both Pudrett, these guys and Ralph Pudrett both have super alphanic simulations, and they both produce more or less this result.
Yeah, but I want to do it like 10 times the resolution, doing the full allele transfer, doing it right.
Okay.
So it's going to be a little different.
Yeah.
Do you know the reference for Pudrett's result?
Do I know the evidence for it?
The reference.
Do you know the reference? Is there a paper out?
It's the preprint that Chilean produced 2007. I don't know if it's in AstroPH.
I've only seen a preprint which Dib gave me, but I haven't seen it.
I could probably give you a preprint.
By the way, this isn't universal. I mean, sometimes these curves are flat, and sometimes but they never actually go in this direction. Are sort of in this.
Is there evidence for the change in the Fanny Mach number? I didn't say. I mean, or not much. I mean, it didn't seem like you showed three different measurements, and the Fanny Mach number. I don't know if it was within the error bars, but it seems relatively constant over a long range of.
It is. That's true. All of these numbers are the same within the uncertainties.
Right.
There's no observational evidence for a change, and they're all consistent with one. That is, I think the uncertainty in all these numbers is about two.
But they are not 4 or 10, right?
Right.
Shouldn't it change with in a turbulent cascade? I mean, should the super-alphanic Mach number? I would have thought that it would have changed as you cascaded down.
Yeah, of course it would.
Yeah, so.
Well, if there's turbulence but no self-gravity, that's the case. I have no idea how a self-gravitating turbulent cascade acts.
What will happen to the signal speeds.
Right, I mean, yeah, but these things are not, these things may have been initially created by turbulence, but the CN clouds in particular, those are held together by gravity. Those are massive star-forming regions, and you can tell, I mean, in terms of the line with size relation, those things are way above the ordinary Larson relation, and so they must be self-gravitating objects that have been affected.
Well, these cores are thought to be self-gravitating too.
Right.
They're the standard sort of ammonia-type cores.
They lie more or less on the line with size, whereas the high-mass ones do.
Yeah, I guess the point I'm making is those high-mass ones have clearly been through a phase of gravitational contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have no idea what happens to the authentic Mach number when that happens. Probably.
By the way, one other thing is that if...
Mostly though the effect of the internal feedback, right, that changes the...
Sure. Well, yes. The fact that those are so hot shows that they've been very significantly affected by internal feedback.
If somehow nature
the fact that those are 50 Kelvin instead of 10 Kelvin means that they have to have a massive star sitting in their center illuminating them, and it's going to add a lot of temperature.
It's just the fact that the Alfheim Mach number seems to always work out to be about one. Is that self-regulation?
Possibly.
I mean, the cloud collapses to a certain point.
But we don't understand that. It used to be thought that that was self-regulation. At least the simulations showed no change in the dissipation of the turbulence as you go through from super-alphanic to sub-alphanic. You just sort of smooth it.
But this is a mean value. There's a huge scatter around the mean value if you look at the block again.
It's a median value.
But
again, when you say when you say there's a scatter,
it doesn't change also as you pass.
When you say there's a scatter, you have to be careful because that table I sent you, it's the orientation problem. So,
for magnetic isomorphic clouds, meaning the mean, that is a natural prediction. We cannot get away from it. It's near Krieger. For the turbulence, people, you can go higher, lower, whatever you want.
I don't understand. The M over FI is one, but why is the
why can't the Mach number be zero
for this problem?
In your case, it's zero because you don't have
case, it might be because of the. It might be because these are alphanic waves.
Alphanic waves have any amplitude. Well, the Alpine wave does not happen.
For the center of gravity in objects, as I argued yesterday, they are close to critical. It's a reflector.
That's the whole
Maybe the self-regulation comes from the fact that if it's too much superalbumic, they dissipate by salt fast, right?
And that's not true.
No. I mean, Mach 1, yes. If the Alpine Mach number were 1 and there were nothing putting in energy, in one crossing time, the Alpine Mach number would be down to, you know, a third.
Right, but if it was 10, it would move faster.
By the way, something Tom Troll and I are doing right now is trying to find background continuum sources like quasars, which line of sight passes through GMCs, and they're going to be weaker than the sample that Hylas and Trolland used, because they looked for that with a certain cutoff. But with, for example, the SKA, with its huge collecting area, it will be possible to go to much weaker continuum sources and COH and H1 in absorption and be able to sample the magnetic field in the less dense parts of molecular clouds. The reason you can't do it in emission is just that the emission lines are very, very weak. But in absorption, they're determined mainly by the strength of the continuum source. And with enough collecting area, that can be very, very viable experiment. So I think the SKA will have the potential to make a big contribution there.
If the ATA gets to its full size, will that be?
ATA full size is about the same as the VLA.
But maybe you might have a friendly attack. is that true? That, I mean, can you imagine getting more time on the ATA than on the VLA? Is the VLA?
I don't know. I think they want to spend half the time looking for little green men. So I don't know how much they'll devote to.
Oh, but they can do it simultaneously.
Well, true, yeah. Maybe, I don't know.
The little green men are adjusting the turbulence.
That's the thing.
They're the ones to look for.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we thank Vicky?
Yeah.
Okay, so the plan is to gather at noon in the founder's room to.